You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
.908 on the West Coast. Joining me are two guys that served together. I don't know if they served together once or twice. Mike, how many times you and Will served together?
He caught up with us when LER just before he took over. And so we served in a combat zone during that time. And then I think he took command, and then I had orders, and I left the battalion.
Right. But
so we were that sounds
like, yeah.
And then when did you guys serve together at Weapons Training Battalion?
Well, he'll tell you that I never worked for him at Weapons Training Battalion. He never got a day's work out of me, he personally. But I had an office. He supplied me with an office, a fitness report, and other accoutrements.
And a lot of ammunition.
Stuff like that. And a lot. Yeah, and a lot of ammunition.
What?
Oh, my God.
Well, it sounds like normally if you write somebody a fitness report, that does technically mean that you work for them. No?
You're not used to the Marine Gunner CW4, CW5 management relationship.
Well, no, you know what I am used to, though? I am used to the Musselman philosophy of work and how gravity actually does work in the Marine Corps. So I feel your pain. So Will, we had this discussion about stopping power, and Mike flipped out one day. Okay. Now this is when he was having problems. This is like pre gallbladder surgery. So I'm not sure if it was the medication or what was going on. So why is stopping power such a problematic discussion?
Listen, you know, you get into this whole thing of lethality, right? And so you're dead. I don't know if you can be more dead than dead. And this whole stopping power stuff, you know, two in the chest, one in the head, you got to hit them. And I'm of the belief that all the stories that I've heard over the years about I shot him 30 times and he didn't go down, it's because you didn't hit him. And it's hard to hit him, right? It's hard to hit him. In fact, we qualify people on the rifle range who never hit their target. So I don't get this whole, you know, you got to have a 45. Well, if you got to have a 45, one out of 58 or a 72, stop, hit them. Two in the chest, one in the head, that'll stop them. Gunner, did I learn well?
You learned perfectly, yes, sir.
Now, but Mike went on to say we migrated from the 38 to the 45 primarily in air, that there was an ammunition solution to the issue of the 38.
Not at that time. We're talking about now. Now problems are solved because of increasing grains, increasing feet per second, increasing, again, bonded core technology with the lead bonds to the jacket. So when it opens, it retains its expansion. It gets bigger as it goes through the tissue, causing more permanent wound cavity, da, 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 da. So, you know, it was like I told you, Mac, we went to war with our 9mm ball target ammunition designed to shoot paper. We went to war. That was our combat round and our pistol.
Yeah, but Gunner, also, let's face facts, right? The pistol is not a combat weapon, at least not the one that we're using. And all the training you do in the Marine Corps with your Beretta just teaches you how you're going to lose a gunfight. And we actually don't want a lot of people out there carrying pistols because they'll just shoot themselves in the foot. And this whole discussion
that was something
about,
that we... Yeah.
You know, precision.
And what was the main purpose?
And, yeah, the main purpose of me carrying a pistol as a battalion commander, so I didn't have to carry my rifle into the chow. Right? You had to be armed. And so, and the other purpose historically, it's sort of a, it's a sign of authority. I'm carrying a pistol. We don't train people to be gunfighters with pistols. And so if we spend a lot of time worrying about pistols and ammunition, we're stupid. And the ones we do train as gunfighters, we've allowed to go off the edge. You know, we're building $2,000 or $3,000 or $5,000 weapons and weapons training battalion for the Force Recon guys or MARSOC or whoever. Buy them a freaking Glock, let them shoot 5,000 rounds, throw it away, buy them a new one, and get them for $300. And the idea of precision in pistol, are you kidding me? This is not the Olympics, right? You're under high stress. You're drawing your secondary weapon to shoot a guy probably at night. I don't think that the precision built into that Kimber whatever is going to have anything to do with whether you put him down or not. Take your Glock out. Know that it's going to fire no matter what it went through. And once you fire 5,000 rounds through, throw it away. How was that, Gunner? Pretty good?
Mac. Yeah, that was pitch. Mac, let me tell you something. And Colonel can attest to this. He went majority his career.
He's not a colonel anymore. He's a civilian.
He's a colonel.
I am a veteran.
He's a veteran. He's not a colonel.
Yeah. Well, he's always going to be the colonel.
Oh, shit.
Like, I'm the gunner, and you're the swope.
You're Mike, okay? That's what you are. You're Mike. Mike, who took his wife's car in to get his oil changed today. How far the mighty have fallen.
Okay, well, let me finish.
Anyway.
So he went his whole life believing everything he was told about all the guns and the application of it. And then when he got to weapons training battalion, the satisfaction for me was watching him, the light bulb come on and go, oh my God, all the time. Oh my. Like, and you see it just like, and then you didn't have to go long into it because he would get it. He would connect right there and see the problem.
Okay.
And we would have general officers in our office and we'd sit and talk to them and we'd get them along and then you see them get it after 40 years of service. And you see that kind of, the stomach bile kind of building up in them. And there's just that sickening feeling like, ugh.
All right, now, hey, Will, tell the story about sitting around the table when, what was the question the commandant asked about marksmanship?
So we were talking about whether we should use the RCO, the rifle combat optic, at entry-level training. And so if you read the Marine Corps order on marksmanship, says that we're going to train Marines to use a rifle they're going to use in combat. And so at that time, the rifle you're going to use in combat was the M16, A4, I guess, or the carbine with RCO. To deploy to the theater, you had to have an optic with it. And so I said, okay, that's a rifle they're going to use in combat. That's what we got to do at recruit training. And so we were actually at the Marine Corps matches, Marine Corps shooting matches, award ceremony. We got the commandant to come down and give the awards to the shooters. And then afterwards, we had a brief about this. And so the commandant polled everyone around the table of whether we should use this. And the argument against it was that, well, it doesn't teach the fundamentals. And so what are the fundamentals? Sight alignment and trigger control. So trigger control is the same no matter what. Sight alignment, the idea that you don't have to align your sights because you're using an optic is crazy, right? Iron sights are technology. Optics are technology. They're just technology. You have to align those sights as part of the fundamentals. And my argument is that we should do that at entry-level training because the only professional marksmanship training you get in the Marine Corps is in the entry level, whether at Parris Island, San Diego, or at Weapons Training Battalion at Quantico for lieutenants. It's the only professional training you truly get.
Define professional for me.
Well, all the coaches there, that's all they do. They are professional rifle coaches. As opposed to when you go to your unit, the coach is the corporal from Motor T, who happened to be an expert last year and was sent to a course.
Okay. All right. Just so everybody understands.
The coaches, Yeah. Okay. And so, and the other thing is, if you want a Marine to actually learn something, you teach it to them in recruit training. And so we put this argument up, and people equated, you know, iron sights were the basics. And I said, no, they're not the basics. They're technology. And someone says, well, what happens if you've got someone that's got an RCO and they lose their RCO and now they got to shoot iron sights we've never trained them? And I said, well, first of all, RCOs, you know, had a maintenance readiness level of like 98.3%. So they're pretty durable out there. And second, if you lose your rifle and you got to pick up a foreign rifle with iron sights and you got to use that in combat, we actually get people like Navy Crosses who do that. And I'm not going to worry about that 1/1,000,000 to 1%. The fundamentals are the equipment that you're taking to combat with you. And so we pulled the table, and every single person around the table voted against me. And so we didn't do it under that commandancy. And then I think Brian McCoy was a CO of 7th Marines, either at that time or very soon thereafter. And he said, screw you guys. And he sent all his Marines and 7th Marines to the range with their RCOs. Mm-hmm. And so we were doing requalification with it. And we're having to train people in requalification on how to do it. And that, I think, started the avalanche, which I believe now it's, in fact, before I left, I think it was part of the new Rickel order, that we actually mean it when we say you've got to go and train Marines with a weapon they're going to use in combat, and that weapon has got an RCO on. So there was a, you know, there's this mysticism and mythology about Marine Corps marksmanship that just violates everything we know about training. You think about crawl, walk, run, right? Everyone believes in that. So what is the most challenging shooting position that we use in the known distance course? Question.
The most challenging for me is the offhand.
Okay, and so when do you actually shoot the offhand in the known distance course?
Out
of your 50 rounds that you shoot.
I shoot it at the two. Well, again, I'm dating myself. I mean, it's been a while.
No,
so.
You shoot at the 200-yard line,
right.
Round number 11 through 15.
Correct.
Complete violation of the crawl, walk, run methodology. So why do we do it that way? Because you got to get throughput. You're not going to send people through prone position, through all the firing lines, and then back up and back down, and so we violate our fundamental training philosophy.
Well, I mean,
something that we all consider basic.
I know, but it is kind of nice to get off the range before noon, right?
Yeah, that's okay. You know, we could get off the range before noon a lot easier. Automate the target system.
Ah! Right?
We refuse to automate the target system. Someone says to me, no, it's important you spend time in the butts. You learn what the sound of the round going over. I said, first of all, okay, I've had rounds go over my head, and I looked at all the Marines, and every one of them was looking in a different direction. No one had any idea. The second, another violation of the way we train. We have a systems approach to training, right? There's a standard, et cetera. If one of the training objectives of annual requalification training is to understand, to be identified based on the sound of a round going over your head, where that came from, then that should be integrated, it should be evaluated, it should be tested. We don't do any of that, you know?
Right, ever.
Think about marksmanship training. When you send your organization away from your home base to do training, what percent of your training day should be spent on that training? 100%, 80%, 50%, 20%, what percent? You're away from your home base.
And on marksmanship?
No, on any training event.
On
you're
any
away from your home base.
I'm away from my
you're
home
doing
base.
Training.
I'm doing training.
Doing training. What percent of your training day should be spent engaged in that training?
100%. I'm away from home.
Okay, so
like, what else
rifle,
am I doing?
When you go to the rifle range, what percent of your time is spent on marksmanship?
Oh, not very much. A part of it.
16 2/3%, assuming 6 relays. Scoring is not training. Sitting on the ready bench is not training. Sitting in the bus is not training. 6 relays, 16 2/3% of your time. So how do you solve that problem? Automate the targets. You bring people in, you leave the shooter in place, the targets are automated, three different target arrays if you want to shoot known distance, automatic feedback, they shoot 50 rounds, they pick up, go home, the next relay arrives, they shoot.
Wow.
People say, oh, my God, that costs money. I said, yes, I know. We are American. We're Westerners. We invest capital. We're not Chinese. Chinese invest labor, right? We invest capital. There's no battalion commander out there today that says, I got plenty of time to do training and can afford to just give away 84% of my training day. There's not one. Give that time back to them. Invest capital.
All right, so why don't we do that? To me, it sounds like an absolute no-brainer.
Because, it would take a capital investment. But we would return literally hundreds of thousands of man hours every year. We don't do it because it's mythology. It's the rifle range. It's, you know, whatever. Are we genuinely serious about annual requalification training? And I'll answer that. No.
Only within the
requalification training is frightening.
Only in the context.
Back me up on this.
Only in the context of our own mythology. Yes, I've even learned that from Mike.
Yeah. Even that though. Yeah. Annual requalification training, at least in Quantico, is frightening. It's scary when you see what Marines think the appropriate thing to do and how to handle a weapon. And this is 2008, 2010. Everyone's been to war. Gunner, back me up.
Yeah. I mean, we value the individual Marine's time at zero.
And we could actually train them. We could train them to be very good with their weapons, with all kinds of things. Simulation, you know, more efficient use, et cetera. And I don't know if you read the Gazette anymore. The latest articles in there about this have been, you know, we need to spend more time doing competition shooting. No, actually, we need to spend more time doing combat shooting. Train like you fight. It's funny, you don't go to the rifle range with your combat gear. Train like you fight.
Give me your thoughts on suppressors.
Oh, I think everything should be suppressed. Right? Think about, and this is, so I have one idea and then one thing I think I can prove. Think if you could control an entire squad front as your voice command. Everything's suppressed. Think if the enemy cannot identify where things are coming from above ambient street noise, assuming we're going to be in an urban fight, right?
Right.
And the other thing is, I don't know this for a fact. I think it makes sense, though. I believe that noise induces stress, you know, and particularly loud noise induce considerable stress. And so if you're in the urban fight, you can't get away from that noise, particularly if you're inside the room. And so I think that suppressors would reduce PTS. It would take the stress level of the infantrymen in a close fight. It would take it down. What percent? I don't know, but a real percent. I think absolutely everything should be suppressed.
All right. Do you have to go?
Yeah, I actually do.
All right. Hold on.
I've had this discussion with Musselman. He taught me everything I know. So
I know.
Whatever I said just came from him. He can take it.
You're a good boy. All right. We'll have you back. We'll have you back on, and we'll talk guns again.
I can hardly wait.
All right, bud.
Thanks, Gunner.
Yeah.
Thanks, Gunner.
We'll see you later. Okay.
Well done, Mike.
Yeah, and he was a great student.
He's a funny guy because when he believes he's right, like most of my friends, they don't care who you are, they don't care where you come from, you're gonna get it in the face, and he will do that, you know. And I'll say the other thing is, is he's a smart guy too. He's a smart guy, and he will give it to you right in the face, and so interesting. Where did you first meet Will Constantini?
At LAR.
At LAR.
When he was going to take over from Duffy White, yeah.
Right. So Will's got a pretty dry sense of humor too, and he's pretty funny. So. So you can see. Okay, what's on your mind today? What do you got going? How was lunch yesterday?
Lunch was great. So what I do now on Wednesdays is I go with a couple of the guys and we go to it's a 24/7 care center here in Granbury. And so there's all types of people in there, and we hold kind of they do like a Bible study there. So we're in there and we listen to them and help them out. And I mean, it's just a really good, it's an eye opener. It feels good at the end of the day, you know, spending time with these people. In a lot of cases, they don't have anybody that comes to visit them and, you know, listen to them and talk to them the way we do.
All right. Here's a message from another Marine. Where were these guys 50 years ago? You know, the things, Mike, how frustrating is it for you, or was it for you, to have these...
Worse than combat.
Did you feel like you were just going crazy, that the world is upside down? Like, these common sense arguments about if we want to be better, if we want to do things better, things we can do to be better, just fall on deaf ears because of the mythology.
Yeah. It was tougher than combat. Because combat, at least you know where the enemy's at. And the enemy is identified by shooting at him. When you're there doing these kinds of things, it was all around you. You didn't know who was basically the enemy who was going to sabotage the ideas and the plans because they grew up thinking something different.
In spite of.
Yeah, it's because their beliefs. I qualified on the left range. I got an extra bench. Doesn't mean anything, guys. Doesn't mean shit.
Interesting. Yeah. Talk to me about the first units that qualified with optics. Did they just do that as regimental commanders? Say, hey, look, I'm in command of this regiment. I'll make that decision. Is that how that went?
Yep. Exactly how it went.
Wow.
I'm in charge, and I agree, and I'm going to do it this way. And people and the establishment fought against that.
And when you say establishment, let me ask you about your small group, your merry band of misfits in the gunner community in the Marine Corps. Do they speak with a single voice? Are you guys all over the place relative to these kind of issues?
Mm-mm. For the most part, most of them, 90% of them believe that, and we fought against that. And then, I mean, the guys that replaced me were picked because of that. Because they were not scared to voice their opinion and fight on and continue to fight. And, you know, great guys, Gunner Christian Wade, who replaced me, and he just recently just took, he's a division gunner, 2nd Marine Division. He took it, and he advanced that ball further, and, you know, and he did a lot more suppressor stuff and gun improvements and, you know, really believing that we need to get better. But it was... For a lot of the gunners, until they were exposed to it, they didn't see that it was a problem. And then when you expose it to them, they got it real quick.
Okay. All right. So once that program's matured enough and the guys in it are good enough that when they see it, they know it.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. All right.
And the only gunners that fought against it were the ones that the ones that were converted from range officers because they had the infantry backgrounds. And, you know, the all fairness thing when the range officer program went away, the born officer program, and we absorbed the infantry guys that had infantry background. There was a good chunk of them that got on board, but there was also that other chunk that, you know, the more senior ones that had that, they've been doing this all their life as range officers and been competition shooters. They were the holdouts.
Right. Then when you guys interface with senior officers and Will's story is with the Commandant of the Marine Corps, talking about qualifying with, mm-hmm. with optics. To me, you know, Will's no dope. When he starts quoting Marine Corps orders, and we all know how we go to combat, it seems to me a no-brainer, that's what you do. A senior officer, did they have more trouble with it? Did they have more trouble with the change?
Oh, yeah. They had a huge – there was a huge separation as far as what they believed because, again, they grew up in a Marine Corps that, you know, they had a badge and they earned it, and they believed that the way they earned it was, you know, because they were such great shooters. And so it was really, really hard to change their mindset.
Interesting.
But that's gone now. I mean, a lot of our friends that came up during that time were battalion commanders, were S3s, you know. Now they're general officers. They've taken it and they understand that there needs to be a change. So it's changing. It takes time.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, I want to raise a question with you that Will raised when he was on earlier today. We're going to take a quick break. The Mike and Mike segment of All Marine Radio here on a Thursday. We've been talking transition, but we're going to change gears a little bit. More of that coming up next, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Nine 9:38 here on a Thursday. Mike McNamara and Mike Musselman, the Mike and Mike Show here on All Marine Radio. So I asked Will if he had any thoughts on the whole Marines United thing. And he said, you know, he said, look, I feel for commanders because, you know, what we have now is a Marine Corps that essentially, and I don't, I'm going to come close to quoting him, essentially lives a lie. We have, he, and then he asked me, why do we have separate training and separate standards? And I said, well, to make sure that female Marines can get promoted. He said, so we have to change that. He said, why? I said, because there's no female that's going to play on Navy's football team, basketball team, soccer team, hockey team, or baseball team. He said, that's right. He said, so if they can't do what we can do, he said, you know, in the British Marines, there are no women. Okay. And there is a respect that you see in that organization because everybody meets the same standard. He said, so we essentially have an organization that has separate standards and has to have separate standards because if you go to one standard, females can't get promoted. He said, and I think, you know, some of this is a trickle down from that. He said, I think, you know, look, we do our best, but, you know, this is a problem in our society. But what we have is we have a federal government that is telling us that women are equals, but we know they're not. And he said, look, I won't tolerate this for a nanosecond. He said, I would crush this because it's ridiculous. He said, but I will tell you, he said, you know, you hear Marines talk. And they know that this is bullshit. And he said, and we're going to break women is what's going to have to happen. And we're going to have to break women in big numbers for this to change. And he said, I think it's absolutely ridiculous. And so we have this double standard. You know, we lecture Marines about the double standard, you know, and the need to respect everybody. He said, but, you know, when you know that it's hollow, and a lot, and Marines do, he said, it's problematic. So I'm curious about your thoughts relative to that whole aspect of this.
So what's the basic question?
The basic question is we have a system in the military that has a separate standard for female.
Okay.
Does that lend itself to this behavior, or is that simply an excuse?
I'd say, man, I don't know if it's an excuse. You know, we have a separate standard because, you know, why do we have a separate standard for women? The physiological differences, right?
Right.
But if the requirement is something to, you know, one thing to join, to be in an organization or, you know, why would we make a change? Why is there a separate standard? So I'm at a loss. I'm not really sure. I know the way we do it, you know, and I'm not caught up anymore. So I don't know if that standard has changed.
Right.
But I know from the past, one of the biggest concerns we had was the fact that, that was it. There was no standard for the males either. You know, the standard was the PFT, basically.
Right.
There was no standard infantry in battalion to be an infantryman. I don't know where that is. I couldn't comment because I'm not sure what has transpired since I've been out.
All right. The, so. Marines into Syria. Did you see that?
No. When did that come out?
Oh, that came out yesterday. Artillery guys.
Oh, artillery?
Yeah. Artillery guys into Syria. And I guess one of the frustrations of CENTCOM was the inability to move units because of a line on the ground that says Syria. When you need to move, you know, artillery units and things like that to better support the fight in Mosul, and by not doing that, you allowed the enemy greater freedom of movement in terms of because you couldn't reach certain things with indirect fire, and air was not always available. So, good thing, bad thing.
Are these the guys that the 11th BU guys that came ashore, the artillery guys,
yep.
The battery?
I believe it is. I didn't see them identified by name, but I'm pretty sure it is.
Yeah, I think I just glanced over it. It's part of, and I think it's just the supporting, you know, the indirect fire guys that were out there firing 777s.
Right. It's interesting. Now you're seeing more and more stuff written about Raqqa. Raqqa is, you know, and the significance of going to fight in Raqqa, and it's Raqqa is a ways into Syria too. It's not like it's like there. It's not like it's across the border. It's a ways into Syria. And I don't know logistically if the Iraqis, I mean, if they can do that. And so certainly interesting kind of taking a look on a map. When you look at Mosul, way at the northern end of Iraq, and you look at where they would have to go to get to Raqqa, it's like, holy smokes, man. That's a hike. So.
Yeah.
So interesting stuff. In fact, as the crow flies, talking about 250 miles from Mosul to Raqqa. I actually thought it was further than that. So anyway, Marines. So
it's not that bad.
No. Marines. To contrast that, Mike, you off the top of your head, you remember the distance from Baghdad to Kuwait City?
No.
It's about 300 miles. So Baghdad to the border, about 270, 260. So about the same distance from the Kuwait border to Baghdad.
From the Kuwait border.
As it is. So the equivalent of the march up. The equivalent of the march up.
Yeah. That would be, you know, how are they getting all that stuff into Iraq or getting all the supplies then up to those guys?
Because the
how they got to own the road.
How would you describe the Iraqi army's logistical capability?
Oh, it's nightmarish. It's you know, it's such a ragtag. Yeah, I mean, it's everybody, man. Cooks, bakers, and candlestick makers
with their POVs.
Yeah, with the little flatbed, you know, trucks all in different designs traveling. Oh. Whatever's running, yeah.
Whatever's running is going. All right, that's the way that deal is. Anyway, we'll stay tuned for more of that because it's a nice discussion about going there. But when you what is that old phrase, Mike? Amateurs talk tactics, pros talk logistics. When you start talking logistics, that's a relatively short conversation.
Yeah. That, I mean, this is, you know, if they're moved up that far, man, this is just the beginning.
Yeah, what you're going to need, you know, and they may have, you know, we'll find out. And let me tell you what, hats off to the Iraqi army. and their special forces and the Peshmerga, because, you know, they're getting towards the end of the whole Mosul thing. And that's no small endeavor. That is no small endeavor.
Right.
And I'll tell you what, we'll see how much longer it takes them, but I think there were some people that thought it would take 6 months, 8 months, and as long as a year. And in a year, they'd still be in there duking it out. So I mean, hats off to the progress they've made so far. And one of the adjustments that was made was that advisors, American advisors, down into battalion-level organizations so they could coordinate the supporting arms better.
And the big key is to remember that al-Baghdadi has abandoned the Mosul fight. So,
right. And again, the question is, do you want to lose everybody? Because at some point, you have to recognize it is exactly what it is. The Mike, the Minnesota State High School hockey tournament's going on. Did you go to that as a kid?
No.
You didn't?
No. No, why?
I just wondered if you had grown up, if you had friends playing in it, if you went down to the Twin Cities, because it's a pretty big event in the Twin Cities.
It is. And, I mean, we growing up in Eden Prairie, we weren't that good to go, so we didn't go.
Well, things changed after you left, man. That became a big-time suburb, and Eden Prairie became one of the Minnesota State hockey powers.
It's a powerhouse, yeah.
Yeah. But so when you lived there, what was it, more rural?
Oh, yeah, a lot more rural. A lot more. So, I'm looking at it right now. So Wayzata plays Eden Prairie. So that's great. I mean, when I was there, when I was visiting, people were telling me that, man, Eden Prairie become a place for young athletes in football and baseball and basketball and hockey. I mean, they're owning it.
Yeah, it's
big. But the population is boom too. So
it's big time wealthy. It's big time wealthy suburb too.
Yeah. I didn't recognize it.
I guess they moved out there and they built the nice houses out in Eden Prairie. Bedroom community.
Yeah, it was nice houses to begin with.
Oh, really? Big
houses.
Yeah. And then is there a lake out there? What's the lake out there?
Is there a lake in Eden Prairie?
Yeah.
There's a bunch of them.
Well, don't say it like that. I'm an idiot. What's the lake? What's the big lake called there?
The biggest lake would probably be. You have Starring Lake. That's a big lake. One of the most popular lakes is Round Lake. That's right by the high school. You got Mitchell Lake. Red Rock. Red Rock is a big lake. Mitchell Lake's a big lake. Starring Lake is a big lake. Those are ones that people usually put small boats on. Not big boats, but just smaller. Bryant Lake.
Where's Lake?
30 lakes in Eden Prairie.
Where's Lake Minnetonka relative to Eden Prairie?
North.
Okay. All right. So it's not.
It's if you go to like the northwest corner of Eden Prairie, Lake Minnetonka, it's called Lower Lake. Lake Minnetonka is a bunch of smaller lakes. So when they say Lake Minnetonka, you're talking about a region. So in Lake Minnetonka itself, you have Crystal Bay, Browns Bay, Lower Lake, Upper Lake, the West Arm. You have all these Wayzata Bay. All these things, all these other lakes that are joined. So it's only maybe, I would say, at the closest, like if you're in the top northwest corner of Eden Prairie, it's maybe 5 minutes away. it's not far at all.
Okay, all right, pretty close. I was that's what I was thinking. I was thinking I was thinking Lake Minnetonka was a big lake near. I guess on a bigger map it looks close, but in actuality, there's other lakes much closer. The breaking news on USA Today's website: Army brass, led by future Joint Chiefs of Staff Martin Dempsey, gave amorous general a pass. Let's see. This goes back to, I'm looking for a year. Guy's name is Custer. He's an intel guy. Stuff happened at Fort Huachuca. This is amazing. This is like a throwback, it sounds like, to something in, you know, 50 years ago. Made a stop by sexy clothing for his mistress. Lied to investigators about the relationship. Subjected his underlings to racist and sexist emails. And allowed himself to be photographed with another woman licking the medals of his formal dress uniform. The report was received and signed by the top Army officials in September of 2010. Major General John Custer, commander of the Army's intelligence school at Fort Huachuca, faced public shaming and the loss of rank. That's when General Martin Dempsey intervened. Dempsey, then the four-star in charge of the Army's training and doctrine command, struck from the record the substantiated findings of Custer's inappropriate relationship and left the board of three generals deciding Custer's fate with two relatively minor charges and a letter of reprimand that Dempsey had issued. Custer's case and Dempsey's intervention were kept in the dark by the Army for years. The matter came to light only after a whistleblower complained to USA Today, which then obtained the report through a Freedom of Information Act request. The military's lack of transparency in meting out punishments allowed this favoritism to go unchecked, said Don Christensen, president of Protect Our Defenders. Surprise, Mike?
He let him off the hook?
Let him off the hook. Eliminated the finding relative to his inappropriate behavior relative to a mistress and all the supporting documents. Eliminated that from the inquiry, from the board. And so without that finding, I guess they were left with very little. And he issued a letter of reprimand, and he was allowed to retire. The article goes on. Dempsey fought a test flight. Dempsey fought attempts by Congress to limit the role of commanders in handling of sexual assault and harassment cases, saying in June, you know what, that's completely different relative to this conduct. The stories in the last year by USA Today about swinging general, Major General David Haight, whose serial promiscuity killed his career, the demotion of the three-star advisor to the defense secretary for drunken carousing at gentlemen clubs, and the firing of another on the joint staff for adultery, showing that misconduct among senior officers has been anything but eradicated. Even the long-retired generals like Custer can be subject to the sanction, blah, 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 blah. Pretty amazing. Pretty ballsy and amazing,
yeah.
To be honest. Pretty ballsy and amazing. Tell me something good in the world today, man.
What's good in the world? I'm not watching the news. So.
That's good that you're not watching the news. Baseball season's almost here. Are you fired up about your Red Sox?
Romo's going to be released from the Cowboys.
Yeah, how about that? Colin Kaepernick.
That's big news out here right now.
Colin Kaepernick, he's without a team.
Yeah, and I hope he stays that way.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. I read an article about him. And it said that a lot of teams think exactly the same about him as they thought about him coming out of college. In spite of, you know, some success with the 49ers under Jim Harbaugh, he has not progressed as a football player. So not willing to give anything close to the money that he's made in the past. So they think it'll be a long wait for that guy. So somebody will take a chance on him. But anyway, another interesting story. A young boy found a downed World War II German fighter plane. Klaus Christensen of Denmark couldn't get the tale of his own grandfather, who told him out of his head that an aircraft had crashed behind their farm in 1944. And so when his son had a history homework assignment, he jokingly told the boy to go out and find the plane that is supposed to have crashed. But the 14-year-old Daniel Rom Christensen turned up in a nearby field. What he turned up in a nearby field was no joke. The remnants of a German Messerschmitt plane, as well as the remains of the pilot, the BBC reported. The dad and son headed out with a metal detector, and then the device started beeping. They borrowed an excavator and began digging the earth into the earth. Starting at around 13 feet down, they started turning up pieces of the wreckage of the BF-109 model. Christensen said they found maybe 2,000 to 3,000 to 5,000 pieces of the plane, books, a wallet, and some cash and papers, then bone fragments and pieces of human clothing. He says he's lived on the property for decades and had never seen a single bit of metal. The two called authorities, and the site had been roped off. Forensics experts are hoping to identify the body. Luckily, my son has something to write about in his assignment now. So, wow.
That's pretty cool.
A boy in metal detector. You know what? And then the other thing is you know, you never know, but hopefully a family in Germany will be able to bury somebody who was lost in the war, and there's a little bit of closure for somebody. You never know with World War II. Sometimes families die out, but maybe somebody's still living in the family that will be able to take the remains and give them a respectful and honorable burial, and so that'll be interesting to see as well.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
I'm just reading that right now. Well, they found the wallet, his papers.
Oh,
found his name.
Yes, yeah, so they actually know who he is.
Yeah.
Wow. All right, man. Have a good day.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, I got to run to the store. It's kind of a cloudy day. It's nice out today. I like it.
Is it hot there?
So.
It was warm early.
It's warm. Yeah, it's probably in the 70s. Feels good.
I know. It's going to warm up out here. It's been cold. Anyway, all right, man. Have a good day.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
The Gunner on a Thursday. That'll do it. All Marine Radio. My thanks. You heard an encore performance of Angie Morgan. Lead star. Check it out. But, you know, one thing that's a... Again, I was. If you had asked me, I would have said approach the civilian sector with caution because they don't know what to make of you. She's kind of changed the way I look at that whole event, and I would say approach the civilian sector with enthusiasm because they need what you have, and you've been trained by the greatest leadership organization on the planet, and that is the Marine Corps. Understand that you're now a civilian. And so if you assimilate and you care about them the way you've been taught to care about Marines and take care of them, you're going to create a great working environment for people to come to. And for some of them, they've never experienced that in their life. So go make it good and watch what happens. My thanks then to Will Constantini for coming on. Vito, as he's known to his friends. And talking about management. And then he raises the question that he raises, you know, this chasm that we have in the Marine Corps because of gender differences that have to be factored in order to promote. And then we turn around and say, yeah, but we're all equal. And people know we're not. And then the efforts of the Marine Corps to make that good. To make that good. Tomorrow we'll do a little cooking. Friday as we head into the weekend. So that'll do it for today. Have a great afternoon. This program repeats itself. If you haven't heard Angie Morgan, stick around. You'll hear her right now. Awesome stuff. Have a great day. On a Thursday, on Marine Radio, out.